Hello, everyone. It's very nice to be back virtually at PI and give a talk. Today, I would like to tell you about topological quantum codes and how we can use them for fault-tolerant quantum computing. So what is quantum information science? Quantum information science is a very interdisciplinary field, which is in the intersection of three of very deep developments of the 20th century, namely quantum physics, information theory, and computer science. And I would like to emphasize from the very beginning that there are very fundamental differences between classical and quantum information. For instance, we can copy classical information without any problems, without any restrictions. However, if it comes to replicating an unknown quantum state, then it's simply impossible. Those differences will make, as we will see, processing of quantum information much more complicated than processing of classical information. These days, we are witnessing that quantum information ideas enter mainstream physics, and we hear in many different contexts about qubits, quantum entanglement, quantum error correcting codes. Those are quantum information ideas that allow and provide different insights into other areas of physics. For instance, condensed matter physics, high energy physics, thermodynamics, quantum information ideas can help with tasks of metrology. So how did it start? Well, one of the first to realize a potential of a new kind of machine was Feynman. He had the following idea of quantum computing, which he specified in a talk 40 years ago. And in that talk, he said that nature isn't classical, damn it. And if you want to make a simulation of nature, you'd better make it quantum mechanical. So it is a very appealing idea to have a new kind of a quantum, a new kind of a computer, a quantum computer. So, $1 million question, or maybe these days $1 billion question, is how can we build a quantum computer? Building a quantum computer is not an easy task. People have been trying for many years, and we're nowhere close to having a quantum computer that is functional. One of the main difficulties is that quantum information is very difficult to control and extremely fragile. And this problem is very aptly captured by the following quote. The large-scale quantum machine, though it may be the computer scientist's dream, is the experimenter's nightmare. So we see that there are all those difficulties, all those problems. We don't know how to control quantum information. So one may even wonder whether it is even possible in principle. And in the early days, this question was open until Shor came along and proposed two breakthrough solutions, which are required to realize a scalable quantum computer. So one of those breakthrough discoveries of Shor was the idea of quantum error correction. The other was the fault-tolerant methods of implementing universal computation. And those efforts to establish a theoretical framework of quantum computing and making sure that in principle there are no obstacles to realizing quantum computers culminated with threshold theorems. And another breakthrough idea of Shor and the factoring algorithm, together with those fundamental reasons that we believe that quantum computers can be built, this really kickstarted the field of quantum computing. So just to give you an insight why from the theoretical perspective, quantum error correction is challenging, I would provide those two reasons. So the first reason why quantum error correction is challenging and more difficult than a classical error correction is that in the quantum realm, we have to handle with two types of errors. We have bit flip errors, we change the state of the bit or the quantum bit qubit from 0 to 1 and vice versa. But also there are phase errors, which are not present with classical bits. And the second reason why quantum error correction is challenging is that, as I already said, quantum states, if we don't know what they are, they cannot be copied. And so we have to use some other techniques to protect to protect quantum information. We cannot just copy it and store it in different places. So let's talk more about quantum error correction, because this is the key ingredient, the cornerstone if you want to build a quantum computer. So what is a quantum code? In an abstract way, a quantum code is just a subspace of the Hilbert space. And we will encode information that we want to protect into that subspace. Later, the encoded information can be affected by the noise, but we're hoping that if we sufficiently spread it all over the system, we will be able to protect it faithfully. And in the context of quantum error correction and fault tolerance, what we typically assume is that the Hilbert space admits this tensor product decomposition. So in the talk, I will assume that the number of subsystems that we have is finite, as well as that every subsystem is finite dimensional. And you can think of those subsystems as qubits. Also, when we talk about quantum error correction and fault tolerance, we make this assumption that the noise which affects the system acts in some acts somewhat independently on each subsystem, and the correlations are not too strong. Okay, so I just told you about this very abstract definition of what a quantum code is, that it should store, it should protect encoded information. But how do we really specify the code? How do we even work with it? Gottesman had this breakthrough idea that some codes can be efficiently specified by providing parity checks that are Pauli operators. What we do is we encode information into some code, and then in order to diagnose errors, we will measure those parity checks. And parity checks are commuting Pauli operators, so they seem to be there are simple operators that we can measure. The code words of a stabilizer code are +1 eigenvectors of those Pauli operators. And as I said, when we measure parity checks and some of them are not satisfied, some of them return -1 outcomes, and then this signals that there are certain errors affecting our system. Another very deep idea was due to Kitaev. Kitaev proposed this breakthrough concept of topological quantum codes. Those codes can be realized by placing qubits on a surface of some object, for instance, a torus. And we can realize them by measuring geometrical local parity checks. So we don't need to be able to access the entire system at once. All what we have to do, what suffices to do, is to measure parity checks which are geometrically local. And this is a very nice framework to work with, because in reality, what we could hope to engineer is some geometrically local interactions. However, logical information that is encoded into topological codes is spread all over the system. It is encoded in a non-local way. So if we want to perform some logical operation, we have to act on some non-local region. And this is good news because, as I mentioned earlier, if we make this assumption that the noise acts in somewhat independent way on different subsystems, then our encoded information will be protected well because the noise cannot simultaneously act on some non-local region. Or the chances of that happening are very small. And also, I would like to emphasize that topological codes are the current leading candidate for realizing fault-tolerant quantum computing due to their high thresholds and also compatibility with the hardware and efficient decoders and logical gates. Here, let me pause for a second and emphasize that topological codes are not only good for realizing quantum error correction and doing fault-tolerant computation. They provide a fresh insight into quantum many-body physics. For instance, and the code words of the two-dimensional toric code provide very concrete examples of topologically ordered states. When we consider simple stabilizer codes in three dimensions, for instance, the Hux cubic code, those models provide very concrete examples of exotic quantum phases of matter that go beyond the description of standard topological quantum field theory. Also, with topological quantum codes, we can exhibit the phenomenon of self-correction, where we encode information into the ground space of some local commuting Hamiltonian, and then this information is well protected from the detrimental effects of the noise. So let me give you an outline of what I'm gonna tell you in the rest of the talk. So in the first part of the talk, I would like to look closer and explain the big challenges that we face in fault-tolerant quantum computing. So the way I see this problem is that there are three moving parts that we can modify and optimize if we talk about fault-tolerant quantum computing. First part is that we have to select a quantum code that we will be able to implement with existing or future hardware. Then we need to develop strategies how we would operate on this code, how we would diagnose errors and be able to correct them. And lastly, and the last piece of the puzzle is how we implement logical operations on the information encoded in the quantum code that we selected at the beginning. And notice that those three pieces are interconnected. So this optimization problem is rather complex. And in the second part of the talk, I would like to tell you a bit how we can address those big challenges in fault-tolerant quantum computing. And I would like to do it by telling you about a new model, a very concrete example, a new topological quantum code that we call the 3D subsystem toric code. We introduced this code last year. And in the second part of the talk, I will tell you about a simple realization of this new topological quantum code. Then I will describe how we can implement and realize a single-shot quantum error correction with this code. And lastly, I will tell you how we can do logical gates in constant time with this code. So let's get moving. The big challenge, the big first challenge of fault-tolerant quantum computing is how we select quantum codes that we are gonna use in our fault-tolerant protocols. So we know that good quantum codes that saturate certain fundamental information theoretical limits exist. However, a question remains, what codes we want to use and how to realize them, how to construct them, how to select them. So there is one crucial requirement, which is particularly prominent when we think of quantum codes. And this requirement is not that present when we talk about classical codes. With quantum codes, what we really want is that parity checks, the operators that we measure, are of small weight. And why is that? Well, we think that the interactions, the operators that we can engineer and measure will only be supported on a small number of qubits. Also, we want that each qubit is checked by a small number of parity checks. Topological codes naturally satisfy this requirement. That's why they're so interesting and so relevant. Another thing to keep in mind when we think of selecting a quantum code is that there are different architectures that one may use to realize quantum computing. So for instance, one may use trapped ions, or maybe superconducting qubits, or maybe photonic qubits. And different architectures provide different opportunities, but also there are different challenges with each and every of those architectures. For instance, when it comes to trapped ions, we are not limited to two qubit gates that act only between nearest neighbor qubits. And such a limitation is present with superconducting qubits. On the other hand, the number of qubits that we can put into one trap seems to be limited. We are not expecting to have more than, say, 100 qubits in an ion trap. And on the other hand, with superconducting qubits, such a limitation doesn't seem to be that bad. We can just make a bigger chip with more qubits. And when it comes to photonic qubits, this is yet another set of opportunities and challenges. So just to give you a little example, what I mean by thinking about the architecture, a few years ago, I worked with a team from IBM. And what we wanted to understand is whether we can implement a two-dimensional topological code, the color code, in a superconducting qubit architecture. But we assume that there is some limited connectivity between superconducting qubits. And namely, we assume that each qubit can only talk to three neighbors. And indeed, we had to jump through some hoops and optimize the procedure, but indeed one can implement the color code with such an architecture, and there of course are certain optimizations one can implement, and we implemented, for instance, flag qubits in the two-dimensional color code. So okay, that's the first puzzle of the piece. The second piece of the puzzle is correction strategies. So in the talk, I am talking about active quantum error correction for stabilizer codes. So what is it? It's a process comprising two parts. First part is we measure parity checks. So remember, parity checks are the Pauli operators, and the code words of the stabilizer codes are plus one eigenvectors of those operators. So whenever we see some parity check that gives minus one, then this means that there must be an error in the system. So in the first part of active error correction, we measure parity checks, and we obtain a bunch of plus and minus ones. This classical data is called the syndrome. And this will tell us whether there are errors in the system. And in the second second step of active quantum error correction, what we do is we use decoders, which are classical algorithms, to process this this syndrome, this classical data. And those algorithms, those decoding algorithms, will tell us what is an appropriate Pauli recovery operator that can remove errors from the system. Although this is a rather simple game that we want to play, it is already hard. In particular, for generic stabilizer codes, finding an optimal recovery for the IID Pauli noise is sharply hard. Another challenge that we face when we think of correction strategies is that the decoders that we use need to be fast. In particular, they have to diagnose, they have to process the information about the error that we extract from the system and tell us about an appropriate Pauli recovery operator faster than those errors appear in the system. So another challenge that we face is when we do active error correction and we measure those parity checks, the measurement errors are unavoidable. And they will, unfortunately, complicate and slow down quantum error correction. And the slowdown can be rather significant. For instance, when we do fault-tolerant computation with the toric code, with the two-dimensional toric code, this slowdown is of the order of the code distance. So that's not good news. The last remark I would like to make about correction strategies is that there are very many imaginative ideas behind the decoders. So in the later part of the talk, I will be talking about the minimum wave perfect matching decoder, but other cool concepts that that the decoders are built around includes stellar automata, neural networks, or tensor networks. Those are some, in my opinion, the most interesting ideas behind decoders for topological quantum codes. Okay, so we discussed.
Alex, I have a question. So what does it mean by measurement error slowdown accuracy?
Oh yes, so if we have measurement errors, this means that the outcomes of the measurements are unreliable. So we cannot trust them. Usually what we are forced to do is we have to repeat those measurements. So instead of making one round of measurement, we will have to do multiple rounds of measurements. And this is the problem that we face with the two-dimensional toric code. And with the model I will be talking about, the subsystem toric code, it suffices to measure those parity checks only once. And even if this information is noisy, we'll be able to do reliable quantum error correction.
So in generic case, how many times do I need to measure the same syndrome?
Yes, so when we talk about the toric code in two dimensions, we would have to repeat the measurements d times, where d is the distance of the code.
Why is that? Why d? Because I thought like maybe
you basically, so the conceptual idea here is that you basically have to balance the probability of errors and the probability of logical failures due to Pauli errors or measurement errors.
Oh, okay, but I thought like if I measure the same syndrome 10 times, then the error rate will, syndrome error rate exponentially decays, right? So
that is correct. But now if you consider, you know, a larger and larger code, if you keep the, for instance, if the 2D toric code, and if you keep the number of measurement rounds constant, the dominant factor, the dominant contribution to your logical failure will not be due to physical error rates, but due to unreliable measurements. So there's no point in increasing your system size. What you should do is you should invest into making more measurement rounds.
Yeah, but shouldn't we only require like a logarithmically many rounds of measurement? That would be enough to suppress syndrome polynomially. So then,
sure. You can balance it out. Yes, you can balance it out. But if you want to have, you know, kind of a balanced suppression of physical error rates and measurement error rates, you know, this has to somehow scale in a compatible way, in a similar way. Yeah, but that's a good point. I would like to emphasize that with standard strategies based on the 2D Torah code, the number of measurement rounds grows when we grow the system on, when we grow the system size. And with this strategy I will be discussing, we don't have to do it. That's the key message. Okay, so this is the second part of the puzzle. So let's talk about the third part of the puzzle, logical operations. So so far I was talking about protecting quantum information from the noise, but the real goal is that we want to process quantum information in a fault-tolerant way. And we want to be able to process the encoded information. And here I see a little bit of a tension, because on the one hand, we want to protect well our information from the noise, from the environment. On the other hand, we want to be able to easy implement logical, to be able to implement logical operations in an easy way. And there seems to be a tension there. So a very simple idea, how we can do fault-tolerant logical operations is via transversal gates. Transversal gates are a tensor product of a single qubit unit trees, and by definition, they do not spread error. So if there is some error in the system, and if we apply a transversal gate, this error will not propagate into other qubits. So a natural question that was asked by Easton and Kneale is whether we can have a universal set of transversal gates for the given quantum error correcting code. Unfortunately, the answer to that question is negative. Also, interestingly enough, we cannot achieve that even if we consider approximate quantum error correction. And here I would like to mention that a simple proof of this approximate version of the Easton-Kneale theorem can be done, was done, I did it last year with Rafał Demkowicz-Dobrzański, using some tools from quantum metrology. Okay, so the Easton-Kneale theorem is a qualitative statement. It says that we cannot have a universal set of transversal gates, but can we make quantitative statement? And indeed, for an arbitrary stabilizer code, we introduced a new code quantity, the disjointness, and with this code quantity, we can rule out the existence of certain transversal gates. So now we're thinking about ruling out the possibility of having some logical operations. So such a task seems to be less challenging than finding those logical operations. We just rule out the existence of certain. And if we have access to this quantity, the disjointness and the codistance. But also what we showed last year is that, unfortunately, finding the disjointness for a generic stabilizer code is NP complete. So this seems to be the first indication, quite indirect evidence that the problem of finding fault-tolerant logical gates is challenging. And there is a lot of anecdotal justification. You know, people have been trying to find those logical gates, and it's rather challenging. It's a rather daunting task.
Hey, Alex?
Yes?
I have a question about this Easton-Kneale. So does it have to be like strictly like a tensor product of on-site operators, or does it generalize to like a finite depth circuit?
The way Easton-Kneale proved it is for transversal gates. But since then, there have been other works For instance, there was work by Bravi and Koenig or Pastavsky and Yoshida, in which they thought of topological codes, but then they thought of unitaries which are implemented via shallow depth circuits. And there, when you think of topological codes, you will have similar restrictions. In the dimensions, you will be able to access the this level of the Clifford hierarchy. What we did with the disjointness is we also studied shallow circuits. We didn't require that the underlying codes are topological codes, and we were able to arrive at similar limitations. So yeah, one can consider a unitary which is not a tensor product of single qubit unitaries, and there would be restrictions there too.
But is it known for like a completely general code, whether this generalizes to finite depth?
Right. So there's also the result by Beverland et al., where they studied the locality preserving unitaries, and they could also impose certain limitations on what one can do. So yeah. So there we know a little bit about that.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. So this was the third piece of the puzzle, logical operations. So now I would like to tell you in the rest of the talk how those challenges can be addressed with the new model that we introduced, the 3D subsystem Torah code. So what is the model? What is the quantum code? This code can be realized. One of the realizations of this code is on the cubic lattice. We would place qubits on the edges. And notice that the cubic lattice is bicolorable. We can color its cubic volumes in red and blue in a checkerboard fashion. And then we introduce parity checks, which are Pauli Z and Pauli X operators, to every blue and red volume respectively. As depicted in the figure, for every volume, we will introduce eight parity checks. Each of those parity checks will be of weight 3, as depicted in the middle figure. On the boundary of the system, on the boundary of the lattice, we will have to introduce some other parity checks. On the top and bottom surfaces, we introduce weight 4 operators. On the side surfaces, we introduce two body operators. So at this point, you may ask why I worry about the boundaries. Why didn't I consider the cubic lattice with purely boundary conditions? But here, there's a fundamental issue. If we consider the model on the manifold that is closed, there would be no logical qubits. So the boundaries are necessary if we want to have a logical qubit. Also, I would like to point out to you that some of the parity checks that I depicted here do not commute. If you look closely at the Z parity check depicted in dark blue, and the X parity check depicted in red, in dark red, they intersect on one qubit, thus they do not commute. So the model I'm telling you about is not really a stabilizer code. It is a slight generalization of the idea of the stabilizer code, namely the subsystem code. And that's what subsystem means. It's a subsystem code is a slight generalization of the stabilizer code. Operators that we measure, the parity checks that we measure are Pauli, but they don't have to all commute. However, what we can form from those parity check operators is stabilizer operators. The stabilizer operators will commute with all parity checks. And so in this model, the stabilizer operators will be associated with volumes. They will be of weight 12. And notice that we can form those stabilizer operators from priority checks by in two different ways. We can either multiply four priority checks in this fashion, or some other four priority checks around that volume in the other fashion. And this redundancy quite significant, will be basically at the heart of the single shot property of the model, which I will talk to you in a second. So now let me make a few remarks about the model. So first, having priority checks of small weight is important. We have to measure those operators, and if the operators are big, then when we implement a circuit to extract the value of the of this operator, the errors can spread. The errors have lots of chances to spread, and so the smaller the weight of the priority check, the better. Also, at this point, you might be wondering what this 3D subsystem toric code has to do with the good old 3D toric code, the stabilizer toric code. And here, let me explain what the relation is. So in the context of 3D subsystem toric code, what we measure is those priority checks. But then the code words of the subsystem toric code have to are by definition are plus one eigenvalues of the volume like stabilizers that can be formed from those priority checks. So if now we enforce that all Z priority checks are satisfied, then we can and map the code words of the subsystem toric code into the code words of the toric code. And this toric code will be stabilized by operators, but those X volume-like operators, as I depicted on the right here, and those phase Z-type operators. And this may not look like the standard toric code because the lattice is slightly different. Like one can redraw it in a way that this 3D toric code will have X-type operators on vertices associated with vertices of the lattice, and the Z-type operators associated with the faces of the lattice. So there's nothing funky here. And we can also go in the other direction, namely any code word of the stabilized toric code will be a code word of the 3D subsystem toric code. And this procedure of moving between two codes, the subsystem code and the stabilizer code. And this is basically the idea of code switching, and I will use it later when we talk about logical operations. Here, I would like to emphasize that this is the first genuine subsystem version of the toric code. And it is quite interesting that no one has done that before us. And why am I saying that? Well, there's an intimate connection between the toric code and the color code. Namely, in the dimensions, the stabilizer color code is equivalent to multiple copies of the toric code. And the other reason why I'm saying that is that for the color code, we do have a subsystem version of that model. It's really striking that no one has proposed a genuine subsystem version of the toric code. And here I would like to make a point that from the perspective of this relation between the toric and color code, I view the 3D subsystem toric code as the fundamental model, whereas the subsystem version of the color code, the gauge color code, I view it as a derivative model. And similarly, as with the toric and color code construction, the subsystem toric code construction is very simple. It's quintessential, one may say, whereas the gauge color code is more combinatorial, more complex. And this shows up in the performance for those two codes.
Alex, yes? I have a question. What does it mean by this first genuine subsystem version of the toric code?
Yeah, so technically, Bravi and collaborators considered a model of the 2D toric code that, technically speaking, is a subsystem code. But that code is, I would call it a fake subsystem code, in a sense that one can implement a constant depth circuit and remove those non-commuting parity checks from the system.
Oh, I see. Well, in your case, this is not possible.
Yes.
How is it obvious to see that?
It is not obvious to see. But it's basically the same reasoning that could be applied to showing that for the gauge color code would be applicable to showing that for the subsystem color code.
So I still don't know what it means by genuine or not genuine subsystem code, but if the code is a genuine subsystem version, then what's the difference? What is the key consequence of that?
What I mean is that those non-commuting operators cannot be removed from the system, right?
So in that case, like if I construct non-genuine version of 3D torque code by this kind of adding non-commuting part and so on, then it behaves essentially the same way as torque code. Am I correct?
In a sense,
like I can't do any single shot error correction, for instance.
Yes. Because it's some sort of an equivalence, right? Relation.
I see.
Yes. Yes.
I see. So then like single shot error correction can be like a distinguishing feature.
That's right.
Okay. That's right. I see. But that's not possible in 2D, right? I mean,
that is not possible in 2D.
Okay. Yeah.
Or at least we don't know. We haven't ruled it out. But I strongly suspect it's not possible.
I see. Thanks.
Okay, so this concludes the first part of the puzzle, quantum codes. So let's talk a little bit about error correction strategies. So the decoding problem for the 3D subsystem toric code is very similar to the 2D toric code decoding. So what is this problem? Well, we have a bunch of string-like errors depicted here by gray segments. We don't know what they are, but we measure stabilizer operators. And by measuring stabilizer operators, we'll extract the information, which can be visualized as point-like syndromes. Those are the endpoints of the strings. So remember, we don't have access to the locations of the errors, but what we see is the point-like syndromes. However, in the subsystem toric code, we measure more. We not only measure the stabilizer operators, rather, we measure the small weight three parity checks. And from those parity checks, we can figure out what the stabilizer operator is. Basically, we can take either one quadruple of parity checks and multiply their measurement outcomes, or the other quadruple. And this redundancy, those local relations between the parity checks are very important and lie at the heart of single shot error correction property. Because if the stabilizer operator returns -1 outcome, then it means that the number of -1 parity checks in the first group has to be odd, and the number of parity checks that give me -1 in the second group also has to be odd. And what it can be captured is the following: parity checks can be that give -1 measurement outcomes form loop-like objects. I call this object the flux, and pictorially, what we will be seeing in the system is the following behavior. We will have those loop-like objects, and importantly, because we have those two groups of parity checks, yellow and green, there would be two types of syndrome, yellow and green, and two types of flux, yellow and green. And the point-like syndromes will be the locations where the flux changes color. And the fact that what we observe is the flux and it forms loop-like objects is a game changer. Because if we have some measurement errors, we will not see the flux that forms loop-like objects. It will form some chopped loops, some string-like operators. Nevertheless, we will not need to repeat parity check measurements. Even if you have noisy measurements, we can still proceed with reliable quantum error correction. And this is to be contrasted with the 2D Tory code, where if we make one measurement round, we can be fooled by measurements, and we will be unable to do reliable quantum error correction. So how do we do, how do we decode, how do we handle this in this model? We propose the following, a single shot decoder. I use the word single shot to emphasize that this decoder uses only one round of measurement outcomes. So the two steps of the single shot decoder are as follows. In the first step, what we will do is we will repair the flux to make sure that it forms closed loops or strings that terminate at the boundary. And from this repaired flux, I will estimate point-like syndromes. And those point-like syndromes are the locations where yellow flux turns into green flux. And it's depicted by blue dots here. And in the second step, I forget about the underlying flux that I measured, and I use only the estimated point-like syndromes. And this reduces to the toric code decoding. I basically have to pair up the points. And that way I can find the recovery operator. And here, what is remarkable about this model is that both steps can be reduced to a problem of pairing up vertices within some graph. And this graph is obtained from the lattice. So we know how to solve this problem efficiently. And here's where the minimum weight perfect matching algorithm comes into play. This is an efficient algorithm. Also, it leads to a good performance, the overall performance of the protocol. And we will need this, this algorithm to prove single shot error correction property of the model. So what do I mean by that? So what is single shot quantum error correction? It is this beautiful idea proposed by Bombin in which he explained that certain quantum error correcting codes are capable or allow one to perform just one round of parity check measurements that are local, geometrically local. And this will be sufficient to perform reliable quantum error correction even in the presence of measurement errors. So this is basically the setting we want to work in. And what now I want to give you a gist of is how we can prove that the 3D subsystem toric code has this property of single-shot quantum error correction, enables single-shot quantum error correction. So to make things more precise, I need to define two concepts. So R sub eta is basically a class of channels that capture the single-shot decoder that I described on the previous slide. And eta describes the measurement error rate. The second concept is the class of channels and tau epsilon. And those channels are parameterized by two parameters. This class captures the bit flip noise that, roughly speaking, I'm kind of simplifying a little bit, all this noise that is in this class has like physical error rate tau and the logical error rate epsilon when the single shot decoder is applied to this noise. So, you know, basically what is important is that single shot decoders operate in the presence of measurement error with some rate eta, and there is some noise with two parameters tau epsilon. Tau basically captures the physical strength of the noise. Epsilon is like the logical error rate. And what we prove, the main theorem that we prove can be succinctly captured by this line. For sufficiently small parameters, eta and tau, eta captures the measurement error rate and tau captures the physical error rate of the noise. The following relation holds. So basically when we have the subsystem toric code and the noise is applied to this system, followed by the recovery operator, which we infer from the single shot decoder, the overall process is equivalent to basically just applying the noise with slightly different parameters to the subsystem to our code. So what is non-trivial about this statement? Well, the class of noise does not change. The parameters of the noise change slightly. And how do they change? Well, first, residual noise can be suppressed and can be basically eliminated from the system if we make measurement errors go away. So if we have access to perfect measurements, we would be able to get rid of the residual noise. And the second important thing is that if we increase, the increase in the logical error rate captured by this parameter delta on the right side of the equation, this increase in the logical error rate due to our error correction procedure can vanish, can be made arbitrarily small if we increase the system size. And just to zoom out, what it means is that the residual noise accumulates slowly during the repeated rounds of single shot error correction. So this is the analytical proof. But what we can do is we can do numerical simulations. And since I don't have too much time, I will be very brief. We do some simulation for the IID bit flip and measurement noise. And what we study is this accumulation of errors. For instance, here I plot the logical error rate as the function of noise strength for different system sizes. And indeed, we see the intersection of those curves. And from the intersection of those curves, we can see that there's a threshold. And then what we can study is the limit of those thresholds if we increase the number of measurement rounds that we perform. So then we study that as well. And then we can estimate the so-called storage threshold of the subsystem Torah code to be above 1%. And this constitutes as a significant improvement over the other competing model, the 3D gauge color code. And here, I would like to emphasize that this advantage of the subsystem Torah code will increase even further if we consider circuit noise. And this is because the 3D subsystem Torah code is simple, the parity checks are of weight 3. And on the other hand, with the gauge color code, some of the parity checks that we have to measure are of weight 6. And the last piece of puzzle is how we do logical gates. So far in the talk, I was talking about a simple realization of the subsystem Torah code on the cubic latitude of the cubic region. However, here I would like to use a tetrahedral region of the cubic lattice, and the resulting code is based on the 3D subsystem Torah code, but it can be viewed as three copies within this tetrahedral region that are fused along the base. And in this code, we have transversal Hadamard and CNOT gates. So this code is depicted basically, you know, with qubits. One dot is one qubit in the base, and one dot above the base is three qubits. And similarly, we will have a related stabilizer code, the tetrahedral stabilizer code, which can be obtained from the subsystem code by enforcing Z parity checks. And as we show, this code has a transversal T gate. So now what we can, another thing which we show is that one can switch between those two codes in a fault tolerant way in constant time. So we end up with is a fault tolerant universal computation scheme that does not rely on state distillation. The gates we do are transversal, and it can be done in constant time. So basically, whenever we need to do the Hadamard gate or the CNOT gate, we operate in the subsystem code. When we need the T gate, we switch to the stabilizer code, we implement the T gate, and then we proceed. And because the subsystem Torah code is single shot, the quantum error correction does not suffer due to measurement errors. There is no slowdown there. So the overall computation scheme can be done in constant time. And by that, I mean every logical gate is done in constant time and error correction is done in constant time. There is no time overhead.
So is this like a, so maybe I missed something. So is it like a three copies of the 3D subsystem toric code attached and the boundary?
It basically captures, you know, that the essence here is captured by our work, which is the equivalence between the color code and the toric code. Mm-hmm. And the model is basically derived from the 3D color code.
I see. But you have three copies. So if I measure the, okay. I see, and thanks.
Okay, so at this point.
Okay, one more question. So still like parity checks the three body?
So here the parity check, so it depends how you do it. So we will have, for it to be single shot, the parity check may be necessary to increase, and maybe, if I remember correctly, four?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. These four are on the bulk, or it's on the kind of...
In the bulk.
Uh-huh. I see. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so at this point, you may wonder, do we have a contradiction with Istinct-Neel theorem? Because I'm telling you about the universal gate set of transversal gates. Well, the answer is no, don't worry. We have those transversal gates in two different codes. So together, those transversal gates form a universal gate set, but those gates are not within one code. So this brings me to the summary of my talk. So I was telling you about the 3D subsystem toric code, which is a new beast in the zoo of quantum codes. It provides the most transparent illustration of a single-shot quantum error correction. And on top of that, it exhibits very good performance in the initial study. And here I would want to reiterate that the time overhead of the fault-tolerant universal computation that is based on the 3D subsystem toric code is dramatically reduced compared to the schemes based on the 2D toric code, because in those schemes, we have to repeat the measurements in order to gain confidence in the measurement outcomes. And we can optimize this scheme further. For instance, one simple optimization, if there's some bias noise present in the system, is the idea that I proposed earlier this month, basically the idea of Clifford deformations. We can apply single qubit Clifford operations to change the basis of the code, and this can boost the performance of the code rather significantly. I would like to also say that, you know, in order to really assess the validity of the scheme, we would need to do a detailed resource analysis akin to the one I've done with some collaborators about the schemes based on the color code.
Alex, can I ask one more question?
Yes.
So what does it mean by good performance? Is the threshold good?
Or? A good performance is basically, the high threshold. Uh-huh. But we also want, remember in this puzzle piece, we want small parity checks.
Yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So you show this, what is in this graph? It says around 1%, is it a good number? And does it consider both like syndrome errors?
This was phenomenological noise where I had, when I had measurement errors. For the circuit noise, this is ongoing work, but this will drop a little bit, but it will not drop super significantly.
I see, but the point here is like, it's three body or four body, so Q is kind of effectively, it's nice.
Yes.
Small. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Thanks.
Okay.
Can I guess more? So
please.
In terms of time overhead,
it's constant.
Is because of the single shot?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I see.
Yes, I am sweeping under the rug the time needed to do the decoding.
Yeah, sure.
Which scales polynomially in the system size, right?
Mm-hmm. And any reason to think that this has a good resource requirement?
So yeah, so I guess this brings me to the next slide.
Yeah.
So the question is, are we done? This is the last slide. So the answer to this question is yes, we're done. Are we done with building a quantum computer? Not really. This is more, you should think of this model as a very exciting model, but it's more like a proof of principle. I'm not saying that we should build it tomorrow in the lab. And in general, we're not done with this fault-tolerant computing puzzle. People are actively researching and finding quantum codes, thinking about efficient correction strategies and how to implement logical operations. So this is an area of very active research. And what I've been thinking of is recently is how to demonstrate fault tolerance and quantum error correction with near-term devices. Can we use the methods that I've presented to you that are illustrated by the subsystem Turing code in real life, in the real demonstrations? And this is a very interesting question, and we still need to work hard to answer it. And also a rather fundamental question, which I've been thinking of these days, is whether the assumptions that are behind fault tolerance and quantum error correction are justified. How well do they match what we really have in the lab? Is thinking about Pauli errors, good enough, or do we really have to think about correlated errors, coherent errors, some crosstalk? Also, I've been working a lot on topological quantum codes, and I've been developing methods which are applicable to those codes. But will those methods be applicable to other codes, for instance, LTPC codes? That's interesting and very important to study. I view topological codes as some sort of a crutch that will allow us to do and handle more complex quantum codes. And lastly, what makes me very excited is that topological codes can give us insights into new physics. And those are the phenomena of single shot error correction, self-correction. And in particular, the model I told you about, the subsystem Turing code, provides the most transparent illustration of single shot quantum error correction. So those insights will definitely be very valuable. And with that, I would like to finish my talk. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex, for that wonderful talk. So, yeah, time for questions. Team?
Hey, very nice talk, Alex. I had a question about this latter point, self-correction. So I'm assuming your model exhibits this one-form symmetry protected finite temperature order. Yes. Is that right?
That's right.
Does that naturally go hand in hand with a single shot QEC? Like are they equivalent pretty much, or not?
So yeah, basically, to establish this connection, that would be on a very solid ground, that would be very, very useful. Indeed, having this one form symmetry is very much similar to having the single shot quantum error correction property. And of course, self-correction somehow implies single-shot quantum error correction, but not the other way around. So not necessarily the other way around, but maybe the implication in the other direction is true. I don't know. Maybe we can find models where, this implication doesn't hold, but I'm not sure. I think those concepts are very intertwined, but I would like to, formalize it, to put it on a solid ground. To really understand what implies what. And I think thinking about those models that have single shot quantum error correction and thinking about quantum and protecting quantum information can give us new definitions of what it means to have like a phase of matter, a quantum phase of matter.
Okay, thanks.
No questions? Annie?
Yeah. Hi, Alex. Thanks for the really nice. Yeah. I had a question about something that you were saying in slide 14, I think, when you were proving that single shot error correction is possible, I think. So can you
give
me more, what exactly are the different types of error rates and noise that you took into consideration?
So I swept under the rug what the noise model is. Roughly speaking, the noise model, or maybe the IID noise model with physical error rate tau would be an example of this model. But this class of models, this class of channels of noises that affect the system are slightly broader. This class allows for some correlations between errors. So you don't you not only have IID noise, there could be some correlated noise, but you know, this noise is suppressed. And that's what basically this parameter tau captures. The parameter epsilon captures what happens if we apply ideal single shot decoder to that noise. And notice that those parameters are somewhat independent. We cannot hope to remove the pre-existing logical error in the system. But what we can hope is that this this residual, you know, the strength of the physical noise is suppressed. So the logical error rate will slowly accumulate. It will it's unavoidable because, you know, at each point we can make a mistake with probability, you know, epsilons. After n trials, the probability of making a mistake, roughly speaking, will be an epsilon. But what we are after is we're after suppressing the residual noise, the strength of residual noise, that this does not go on out of control. And that's what this proof is about.
Okay, so just correct me if I'm wrong. So from what I understand, in the theorem that you've underlined, what you've proved is that having a single shot decoder with some measurement error, in addition to whatever physical error rate and ideal logical error rate you have, having that is equivalent to having an ideal single shot decoder, but with higher logical error rate. But at the same time, you can prove that you're able to suppress the logical error rate.
Right? Yeah, or you know, how basically what is captured by this equation, that I have some noise and then I apply the decoder, and the overall process is equivalent to just having noise in the system. And the type of the noise is the same, it's the same class of noise. The parameters okay. of this noise are slightly different. Tau prime can be arbitrarily suppressed if I have better and better measurements. And the increment in the logical error rate, this delta guy here, this can be also made arbitrarily small if I just increase the system size. So it's very beautiful how those things go hand in hand.
I see. Okay. And also, I think that at some point, I'm not sure if I misheard, but I think at some point you said that in order to prove single shot QEC, you needed to use the minimum weight perfect matching.
Yes, that's very good. You didn't misheard. It was so in the proof we currently have, we need to know that the recovery operator that we apply in the system is the smallest weight, which is equivalent to the most likely operator, and this is a key step in the proof. Luckily, with our code, we can find efficiently such a most likely error consistent with the observed syndrome.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. That's all my questions.
Thanks.
Any other question? All right.
Hi, Alex. Nice talk. In your last slide, you made a comment about demonstrating fault tolerance and quantum error correction in near-term device. So exactly what do you mean by this, and what would satisfy you as a demonstration? So there's been a lot of experiments kind of claiming they've done some piece of quantum error correction. So are you making the bar higher here, and what is it?
I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say, what I'm thinking of currently, but I would like to see that we can run multiple runs of syndrome measurement and do error correction. So far, the the demonstration which is the nicest in my opinion, because they have the most syndrome measurement rounds, is the one due to Honeywell. Where they kind of implemented the scenes code also, which can be also viewed as the smallest instance of the two-dimensional color code. But what I mean here is that imagine I give you you know, a few superconducting qubits, and you know, how should I lay them out that I can squeeze the most out of them? Maybe I can have 20 qubits, but like connectivity is somewhat limited. What can I do with them? Or maybe I need to invest into building demonstrating, implementing certain non-local gates. How much could that give me? Is this effort even needed? Maybe I can do everything with the planar architecture and nearest neighbor gates. Another important question here is, we need to study the people, including myself, who do error correction. We need to dig a little bit deeper into the underlying physics of the device, because there, if we understand the sources of the noise model, we would be able to leverage it, maybe design better quantum error correction protocols. What it means to demonstrate fault tolerance, this is a difficult question. And there is a nice talk of Daniel Gottesman at QEC 2017, in which he explains all the subtleties that go into demonstrating fault tolerance. I think this is a difficult question, and I'm not sure we fully understand what it really means to demonstrate fault tolerance. But I guess you know, we don't have to prove that planes fly. We just build them and we fly them and they fly, so it's all good. And I imagine similar things could happen with a quantum computer. We just need to be kind to our experimental friends.
So we have to think from an engineer point of view, not from a purely a mathematical point of view.
I guess you know, this is true when we talk about error correction and performance of quantum error correcting codes. We can prove a theorem, and then we know that the threshold is, you know, 10 to the minus 10, but then we run numerics and then it turns out to be 1%. So suddenly it becomes more realistic, yeah.
Thanks.
Right, so I think we had lots of questions. So let's thank Alex again. A great talk. Thanks.
Thank you.